ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Wednesday, the 13th of March. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, grave concerns for seven missing family members as major flooding hits outback WA. And fresh doubts over the AUKUS deal as the US scales back submarine production.
This is really a case of us being mugged by reality.
This is a challenge desperately needing government certainty. And until that is provided, there's going to be clouds hanging about its future.
Some of the poorest classrooms in the country are in for a big injection of funds, with the Commonwealth pledging to double its funding for schools in the Northern Territory. It's the latest in a blitz of funding announcements in the NT in an effort to address the Indigenous Closing the Gap targets. Indigenous Australians Minister Linda Burney says she's also continuing conversations about the government's next move after the failed Voice referendum. But some advocates are holding out hope that the Voice could be legislated. Jacqueline Breen reports.
Michelle Ayres loved her job teaching in the tiny desert community of Utopia north of Alice Springs and the students and families she worked with. But she watched things go from bad to worse in the territory education system over the past decade.
For the last 10 years, we've seen a downward trajectory of attendance and engagement in schools across the territory. Our buildings are, some of them you wouldn't put, an animal in, and that's the easiest way to put it.
She quit teaching to join the union and lobby politicians to turn things around, and has been waiting for a day like today.
Absolutely a huge amount of change. We're talking about children getting the learning they need, which is really going to set them up. And that kind of difference, it's really difficult to put that in words. Like, we're talking about the Northern Territory's future and really Australia's future here.
An investment of $1 billion from the federal government over the next 4 years will mean territory schools are fully funded according to the needs-based Gonski model. It's the latest in a string of big funding commitments announced in the territory in an election year by the Prime Minister and Indigenous Australians Minister Linda Burney.
This is very much our way of showing that we are very serious about closing the gap. We've made a priority in housing and a priority in employment, which is why you've seen a $4 billion commitment yesterday to housing in remote communities for over 10 years. And then we also made $1 billion to bring schools up to a good standard here in the Northern Territory.
$700 million was also announced last month to create 3,000 jobs under an overhauled remote jobs program replacing remote work for the dole. The commitments have been framed by the government as practical measures to close the gap. Practical measures being a kind of Canberra speak for policies other than the Indigenous voice to Parliament defeated at last year's referendum. The government is still yet to clarify whether its commitment to the Uluru Statement from the Heart holds in full. Minister Burney said again today that conversations with Aboriginal groups are ongoing, including on this visit to the territory. She was specifically asked if local and regional voices are actively being discussed.
Well, at the moment, I can't. Only because I'm not going to break cabinet solidarity. But I can assure you, there is extensive discussions and consultations going on across the country, not only in relation to closing the gap, but also in relation to the sorts of things that we want to go forward with.
Since its defeat at the referendum, advocates for The Voice have had a lower profile but are watching the government's moves now closely. Uluru Statement advocate Thomas Mayo is urging the government to honour the commitment made to The Voice through legislation, if necessary, and to treaty and truth-telling.
Well, Minister Burney's right. There is a lot of conversations that are happening, and, that is one of the ideas that has been thrown around. I hope that the Australian people will see this as a positive, and when announcements do happen about how the next big step forwards are done, they get behind it and support what Indigenous people are calling for.
That's Uluru Statement advocate Thomas Mayo there, ending that report from Jacqueline Breen. Severe weather is hampering search efforts for a missing family of seven in major flooding in WA's outback. Hundreds of millimetres of rain have fallen on the region, and locals say they haven't seen flooding like this in decades. Our WA-based reporter John Daly joined me a short time ago.
Police hold some really grave concerns for this family of seven from the remote Indigenous community of Junjunjara. So they were heading home from Kalgoorlie, which is about 600 kilometres to the west, in two four-wheel drives, and they really haven't been heard from since. Now, police tried to do an air search across that vast area yesterday, but they had to call it off because of really low cloud and bad visibility. It was just too dangerous for them to fly. Now, police are hoping that things will clear up, the weather will get better, and they can resume the search for this missing family. And there are four kids aged between 7 and 17 and three elderly people in this group, so they're really worried.
John, how has this whole situation affected the remote Indigenous communities?
Well, regarding this missing family, the locals in Junjunjara are understandably extremely concerned, especially when they hear that police say the group was carrying minimal food and water. Now, they hope that they've just managed to stay with the vehicle and they can find them soon. The community itself will be cut off by road for quite some time, but there are still planes that are managing to get through to the airstrip and a small number of trucks that are getting through with food and water. Now, John Luck is the chief executive of the local Aboriginal corporation at Junjunjara, and he says that this flooding event is extremely rare.
In the 35 years that I've been out there, there have been large rain events. There's been times before where they've had more rain, so they've had to airdrop food in. So we have had these, so I guess they're once in a 25-year kind of cycle rain at this level. So, yeah, we have seen it before, but it's very unusual.
That's John Luck there. And John Daly, what's been the broader impact of these floods?
Well, the Eyre Highway, the only sealed road connecting Western Australia to South Australia, was closed yesterday but has since reopened this morning. It's also an extremely, as John Lark said, extremely rare flooding event for this region. Cattle stations have been completely cut off and had to be evacuated. Now, just as an example, Eyre Station reported 320 millimetres of rain. That's more than their entire average rainfall for the year. And if anyone that's travelled across the Nullarbor can imagine this landscape, it's incredibly flat and dry with little in the way of significant vegetation or trees or land formation. And it's just been drenched with hundreds and hundreds of millimetres of rain. Now, this has all been caused by a very stubborn trough that has sat over this region for the last several days. But the Bureau of Meteorology says that this weather system will hopefully move east into South Australia this evening, and conditions will soon ease, which will allow this search for this missing family to get properly underway.
John, how long will it take to get a proper sense of the scale of this flooding, given it's such a big area and a lot of these communities and stations are very remote?
Days, possibly weeks. I mean, we're talking about a lot of water on this landscape that isn't going to go anywhere anytime soon. Roads being cut off, communities having to have food and water flown and trucked in. So the full impact of this isn't going to be known for quite some time. I mean, this hasn't happened in several decades, and a lot of these communities don't usually see this kind of rainfall at this time of year. It usually happens during winter. So I suppose it's going to take quite some time for this water to dry up, to dissipate from the landscape, and that will allow people to kind of return to the land and understand the damage that's been caused to livestock, to infrastructure, to everything associated with this.
That's our reporter John Daly there in WA. An aid ship is on its way to Gaza from Cyprus as international efforts to establish a makeshift seaport intensify. The US military is also sending a ship carrying equipment to build the temporary pier off the coast. But Gazans fear this new gateway could allow Israel to go ahead with its planned ground invasion of the southern city of Rafah. Nicole Johnston reports.
A parachute floats from the sky into the streets of Gaza City, a box of food attached to it. It lands and is suddenly surrounded by hundreds of people. It's survival of the fittest. Only the strongest can get the aid. Gaza journalist Sami Ziara.
The airdrop, it doesn't make sense, it doesn't help, doesn't let all the people to get the food.
Head south to central Gaza at Nitzarim Junction, Trucks haul large blocks of concrete, building a temporary port, so the first aid shipment from Cyprus can dock. It's opposite the enclave's old horse riding school, which is now rubble. Sami Ziara has seen the pier's construction and believes once it's in place, Israel will prepare to invade the southern city of Rafah.
So it looks like that the Americans, they are serious to do this port, and they will let the aid coming to Gaza, to the north and Gaza City, through the harbour. I believe that the Israeli, they will, for 100%, they will invade Rafah. Because if they do, it means that Rafah crossing will be shut down, as well as Karim Abu Salem. So there is no crossing going to be let any aid be entering, only the harbour. So it means that they are working to find other source or other, gate.
It will take the aid ship around 3 days to reach Gaza. Supplies will be distributed by an organisation called World Food Kitchen. But with 300,000 people starving in the north, with lawlessness and looting, security is a nightmare. Laura Lanuza is the project director for the charity sending the aid, called Open Arms.
They are flour, rice and canned foods like tuna or beans. 3 weeks ago, it was nearly impossible to open this corridor. It was nearly impossible to be able to have over 200 tons of food to Gaza. And 3 weeks after, it's done. It's possible. It's in its way. And hopefully it will arrive, and hopefully it will be the first one of many.
The Israeli army started its ground invasion in the north of the Strip and worked its way down. But it still hasn't found and killed the top leaders of Hamas. It's been fighting in Khan Yunus. That battle is almost over. Only Rafah is left.
The real war will be starting after the Israelis finish the war.
What do you mean?
When the people going back, checking what has been left, where they are going to stay. 1 week ago, I went to Khan Yunus. I went inside Khan Yunus and I filmed there. Nothing left. Every building has been destroyed. If it's not by airstrike, it's by tank. If it's not by tank, by bulldozer. If it's not by all of that, it's burned. The street, it's something unbelievable. In every single street, they are digging the street 10 meters underground. The shops, the cars, the school.
How do you think the people will react once they see that there is nothing left of their homes?
And most of the people, they need to leave Gaza. Nothing left. No work, no electricity, no water, no food. Why they should stay? If the people, they have money, I'm sure that they will leave Gaza. But the problem that they have no money to leave.
There is one way out. If you pay around $10,000, you can get special coordination with Egyptian authorities. And without Israeli permission, you can board a bus to Egypt through Rafah. Most well-off Gazans have already left that way. The poor, the weak, the hungry remain in the Strip. More than 2 million people.
That's Nicole Johnston. This is The World Today. New figures show the consumption of methamphetamine in Australia has increased by 17% over the past year. The analysis of wastewater found Australians use more than 10 tonnes of meth, which indicates a return towards pre-COVID levels. But the figures don't show how many people are consuming the drug and how much harm it's causing. Professor Alison Ritter is the director of the Drug Policy Modelling Program at the University of New South Wales. She says some other studies are giving a detailed picture of methamphetamine use.
So last week, the National Drug Strategy Household Survey was released, which is a survey, a nationally representative survey, asking people about their drug use. What it showed is that in relation to methamphetamine, there's been no increase in the numbers of people using methamphetamine compared to 2019, the last time the survey was done. The one thing that has gone up is hallucinogens. So, you know, psilocybin, magic mushrooms, LSD, those kind of drugs.
Anecdotally, are there more Australian families who are dealing with the issue of methamphetamine in their extended family now?
You know, one thing we can say from the National Household Survey is that we know that one in five people had used an illicit drug last year. What that means is everybody knows someone. one in five people is a really large amount. And it means that our drug problem affects everybody. It affects families, it affects communities. So it's really entrenched, I think, in Australian society.
What's the situation for families, particularly with methamphetamine, if they have a family member who has become tangled up with this drug and families want to get some assistance? What do we know about the availability of services and places compared to the number of people that may be using methamphetamine?
I think it's really, really tough. I think it's really tough for families to know what to do. Australia actually has a really good treatment system. However, we also know that there are long waiting lists to get into treatment, and we simply don't have enough treatment places for everybody. There's a significant gap between the numbers of people wanting treatment and the numbers of people who are able to receive treatment.
How much wider is that gap for disadvantaged and particularly regional communities? We know that crystal meth, it really has got into the regions in a significant way.
It certainly has. And in fact, to go back to the wastewater release today, what's really interesting about this new data is that in capital cities, the kilograms of methamphetamine has dropped, but in regional areas, the kilograms of methamphetamine detected has risen. Regional areas of Australia require significant attention, and at the same time, they have fewer treatment services and fewer support systems.
Sometimes for this with families, is there a sense that this is going to end up in the criminal justice system? There's nothing that we can do about our cousin, brother, sister. There's no treatment readily available. They're either going to, you know, wrap the car around a tree or they're going to get arrested.
And that's the tragedy of the situation that we have. In the National Household Survey, people are asked, what do you think should happen to someone caught with a quantity of methamphetamines for their personal use? And 72% of people said they wanted them to not have a criminal arrest. So 50% of them wanted them referred to treatment, 16% said a fine. So the vast majority of Australians don't want people to end up with a criminal record.
That's Professor Alison Ritter from the University of New South Wales. Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says Australia has been mugged by reality over the AUKUS submarine deal. It comes a day after the US announced it was scaling back its submarine production, raising doubts if it can provide Australia with three nuclear-powered submarines next decade. Angus Randall reports.
It could be more than a decade before the first American-built submarine is handed over to the Australian Navy, but there are already signs of delay. Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull worries about the repercussions of the US reducing its submarine construction.
The Americans are not going to make their submarine deficit worse than it is already by giving or selling submarines to Australia. This is really a case of us being mugged by reality.
In US President Joe Biden's latest budget proposal, he announced the Navy would build one Virginia-class nuclear-powered submarine next year instead of two. In order to meet the current AUKUS timeline, America needs to be building at least two submarines a year. Malcolm Turnbull says if there are fewer submarines to go around, the US will put its needs first.
The reality is, unless the Americans are able to dramatically change the pace at which they're producing submarines, and there's no reason to believe they'll be able to do so, we will not ever get the submarines that were promised under AUKUS.
Malcolm Turnbull is not alone in his concerns. Rex Patrick is a former independent federal senator for South Australia and former submariner. He says if America slows its production down, there's not much Australia can do.
The fine print is really important. It says that the boats can't be transferred unless the United States president can certify to the Congress at the time of the transfer that the giving away of a couple of submarines will not degrade the US undersea capability. Now, those words could mean anything that a president wants them to mean.
Australia is supposed to receive three Virginia-class submarines from the early 2030s. It will then start construction on its own nuclear-powered AUKUS-class subs in Adelaide. The two projects are intended to be separate, but the US delays may have widespread impacts. Michael Shoebridge is the Director of Strategic Analysis Australia.
So the design of the joint Australia-UK AUKUS submarine is meant to be happening independently of US production, but it's likely that it's going to use a US-sourced reactor, for example. There's no escape from the supply chain issues that the US has. And unfortunately, the UK submarine industry is in worse shape than the US one.
In Adelaide, there are fears the continued uncertainty will hurt confidence in the local industry. Martin Hamilton-Smith is a former South Australian Defence Industries Minister and Director of the Australian Sovereign Capability Alliance.
What is needed is certainty and money on the table. Now, the current government's gone some way towards that in its most recent announcements, but it needs to go further. Otherwise, you can't expect business and workers to invest in their future. They'll go off to other industries. This is a challenge desperately needing government certainty. And until that is provided, there's going to be clouds hanging about its future.
A spokesperson for Defence Minister Richard Marles says all AUKUS partners remain committed to the plan outlined 12 months ago and are working at pace.
That's Angus Randall there. Well, no one's declaring victory just yet, but it seems the crackdown on criminal scammers might be starting to work. A report from the National Anti-Scam Centre shows losses from scams are decreasing slightly as regulators turn up the heat on cyber crooks and as consumers become more savvy. But Assistant Treasurer Stephen Jones has branded Facebook's owner Meta as an outlier in the fight against scammers. I spoke a short time ago with the ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan. Peter, we've all received some of these scam calls and people have been cheated out of billions in total. How sure can we be that the fight against scammers is starting to turn the corner?
Well, Sally, you wouldn't call this a dramatic downturn in scams, but the upward trend is beginning to head south just a bit. The ACCC's latest report says Australians reported $82 million in losses in the final 3 months of last year, the average reported loss of around $1,200. But that's down 26% on the previous quarter and 43% on the previous year. Investment scams down 38%, cryptocurrency scams down 74%, people being hoodwinked into bank transfers down 31%, other scams also trending down, dating and romance scams, employment scams, false billing, phishing, identity theft, online shopping scams. These are all part of life, but especially for the vulnerable, senior Australians, First Nations people, and people with disabilities. Assistant Treasurer Stephen Jones is attending a global fraud summit in London, and he told me banks still need to work harder, but he reserved his biggest criticism for Facebook's parent Meta, describing the global giant as an outlier in the fight against criminal scammers.
Social media platforms are also a major vector, and I've got to say Meta is one of the outliers here. We've actually seen much poorer performance in this area. Scams still rife on Meta platforms, and in fact, over 65-year-olds accounting for a significant proportion of scam losses.
And given Meta and its decision to withdraw funding for Australian news organisations, is the pressure going to be on Meta to actually do more to stop these scam sites?
Look, I'm at a anti-fraud summit here in the UK, and the very clear message from this summit to Meta is they've got to do better. They just can't throw their hands in the air and say, oh, this is not us and there's nothing we can do about it. If you're going to be a good corporate citizen, that ensures that you have a responsibility to the people who are using your platform and a responsibility to the countries that you're operating in. And frankly, to date, they're not living up to that responsibility.
That's the Assistant Treasurer, Stephen Jones, speaking from London. And Peter Ryan, the ACCC report has outlined a few new scams that we need to be careful of, including one about funerals.
Well, that's right. During the COVID lockdowns, funerals were held online, and that's now still very common. But now the National Anti-Scam Centre has detected a funeral service scam where friends and family are asked to subscribe to a funeral video stream with their credit cards. They sent Facebook friend requests from a seemingly legitimate account. People pay up, get nothing, and then the scammer fails to cancel the subscription, so nothing delivered and the money vanishes. Facebook's parent Meta has acknowledged they're aware of the scam and they say they're taking action.
Peter Ryan, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It may have passed you by, but right now, the big news publishers in Australia are in an almighty standoff with the tech giant Meta. Meta runs Facebook and has decided its users don't care for news content anymore. Today, when social media dumps news, is it game over for journalism? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.